Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
I suffered so badly from imposter syndrome. I mean, don't we all? I would sit there in that chair thinking, you know, those other dragons are smarter than I am. They've got bigger businesses than I have. They've got more experience than I have. And then just assuming every entrepreneur walking through the door, well, if I make an offer and one of those other dragons makes an offer, why would they ever pick me? 15 when we got together, and it wasn't even like love at first sight. He was the star of the local cricket team. I was the scorer. He used to go with my dad on a Saturday afternoon. He came in the score box, asked for my phone number. And I felt like going around and waving that bit of paper in the faces of all those tutors who said I shouldn't do it and I couldn't do it, and thinking, I'll show you who can't do it yet.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a hugely successful entrepreneur who started her business, which now turns over £37 million a year, from her bedroom on campus at university. In fact, by the time she graduated, she was already turning over £500,000 a year. Born and raised in County Durham, her parents ran the local village paint and wallpaper shop, and she headed off to university loosely with a plan of getting a business degree before returning to possibly work in the family business. However, in her third year of study, she was required to get a work placement. So for a year, she worked in a small local craft company, and while she was there, spotted a gap in the market for a tool that could create bespoke envelopes for those who made handmade cards. With the help of a local carpenter and her dad, she designed a product called the Enveloper, which she launched on a TV shopping channel after cold calling them for a spot, selling 30,000 units within 6 months. Shopping television has been a huge part of her success. She's been selling her craft companion wares on QVC and shopping networks the world over for more than 20 years now, and has painstakingly grown the business alongside her husband, Simon. They married in 2007 and shared two children, Charlie and Oliver, who they raise in County Durham. And in 2016, she was awarded an MBE for her services to the economy. She's been a dragon on Dragon's Den for 4 years now, and also hosts BBC Two's Ultimate Wedding Planner alongside First Dates, Fred Cyriax, as well as having enjoyed a spin or two around the Strictly dance floor when she competed on the show 2 years ago. She continues to sell her crafts around the world and has a new book out, Craft Your Year, tapping into her years of experience making millions via sticky back plastic, glue guns, and pipe cleaners. I can't wait to talk to her. Let's dial her in, shall we? It's Zara Davis. How are you?
Well, after a warm-up like that, I tell you what, I'm feeling the pressure.
Well, unless I've littered that with lies, it's all true.
Do you know, yes, you say that, but it's not very often someone puts everything together in one sentence like that and just throws it at you like a big beach ball. And I'm like, oh, God, yeah.
But I think everybody should have an intro like a beach ball thrown at them every day, because it gets your shoulders back and your head up, and it's the best bits of you that you can take out into your day. Do you know what I mean?
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So what I'll do is I'll just record that and send it on a WhatsApp, and you can have that every morning as some sort of meditation.
I love it. Firstly, I could set it to be my alarm clock, so my alarm wakes me up. I can just listen to your voice waking me up.
I'll even do it in a more whispered tone, so it's not such a rude awakening. Oh, it's so nice to talk to you. I've been following your story with such interest, because it should be turned into an ITV drama and Sheridan Smith should be playing it. It's that good.
I do like Sheridan Smith.
Do you know what I mean? But look at you. You know, you're a young girl at university. You're still a girl, really, with an idea. And by the time you leave, you've got a turnover of £500,000. And what would you call the developer? An invention?
You know, people always laugh at me when I say I make my millions selling envelope making tools. And I remember being on Gogglebox. Well, they had Dragon's Den on Gogglebox once, and the guys on Gogglebox were like, isn't that that girl that made millions selling envelopes? The thing is, if you don't craft, you wouldn't get it. But those people who were into craft, who spent hours making these beautiful cards, as soon as I can show them, you can make a gorgeous handmade envelope. And I always say, you wouldn't buy someone a birthday present and then wrap it in an old piece of newspaper, would you not? So why make a beautiful handmade card and not put it in a gorgeous envelope? And as soon as you start and explain, the thing is, so many women, two-thirds of all women, are into some form of craft. So people can totally connect with it. They just need their eyes open to it. Yeah.
It's therapeutic. But also, it works because you land it well, right? You walked in to your work experience, your work placement, and you spotted an opportunity, because I know it wasn't the egg came before the chicken, is that right? You know, your love of crafting was born out of your passion for the business opportunity that you found in year three at uni.
Yes, I think that is, nobody's ever articulated it quite like that before, Kate, but I think you're absolutely right, and that my passion was business, and most people in our industry, craft was their passion and they made their passion or their hobby into a business. I didn't. I just wanted to have a business. I'd seen my parents running their own business. And I always say to people, running a business, it's not a career choice. It's a lifestyle choice, because it's all consuming. It takes all of your life. It is everything.
I know. And then people go, oh, you're so lucky you work for yourself. You're like, you're kidding me. I am HR. I'm a very tough boss because I don't give myself holidays. You know, it's like, it's a lot.
It's true. People have no idea. But I think once you choose that path, I just needed to find my industry. And as soon as I stumbled, and it really was a stumble upon that craft industry, my word, I fell in love. I fell in love with the people who crafted, because the customers in that industry are so passionate about what they do. You know, it's almost like craft's been like the best kept secret in the world for so many years. People, used to say crafting a few years ago, and people think your grandma knitting. You know, it wasn't trendy and it wasn't cool. And then all of a sudden, these last kind of 10 years or something, it's had this huge resurgence, and all of the talk of well-being and mindfulness, and now everybody wants to know about
craft. Because it's therapeutic. You know, you've got Tom Daly crocheting and doing needlepoint, you know, and you go, okay, you know, yeah, there's a generation that are finding ways to find wellness away from a screen, right? And so that's something we don't factor in, because we're of an age where we can remember life pre-internet. But for anybody that's kind of, you know, born after, you can't remember a life without screens and connections and uploads and downloads.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I just think, you know, for a lot of people, it is, you know, a lot of people start a new craft watching, with a bit of screen time, watching a YouTube tutorial, learning how to crochet, or, you know, following a pattern or something. But then once you get into it, it is that downtime.
Totally, totally. I completely get it. And then you probably found that same level of passion in the ballroom world, because I grew up in the Midlands, as you know, and in the Midlands, ballroom dancing was huge, right? So it was no surprise to me that Strictly became everyone's favourite Saturday night show. But because I'd been in that world as a young girl. And, you know, my mum had sat there gluing sequins onto secondhand dresses that didn't fit me properly because that's all we could rustle up. But I really wanted to go and compete in Wolverhampton, you know. But again, it's that same sense of community that you get in the craft world where people are just nuts about it.
Oh, yes. And do you know, the people who do it, it's not a hobby. It's not even a passion. It's their life. And you don't appreciate it until you're thrust into their world. And do you know what it is about the dancing? Even more so than crafting, it's the way it makes you feel. And you know, I felt $1 million, not just every time I stepped out onto that dance floor and my hair was all done and my makeup was fabulous, but every time I was in Ali Ash's arms just being twirled around the dance, because we used to train at like 6 o'clock on a morning, and you know, it'd be lovely, kind of, it felt like the middle of the night, it was still pitch black outside, and we used to dance at this tiny little dance studio around the corner from me, and they just gave us our own key. So we just used to let ourselves in on a morning, we had our little routine, I'd unlock the door and then I'd go and put the alarm off, and he'd go and set up all the PA system, put the music on, and I would get us a cup of coffee ready, and then we'd just be dancing, and it just felt like nothing else in the world mattered or existed. We were just lost in our own little world, and you feel so good just dancing.
It's the endorphins, isn't it? And then the fact that as well, I think, you know, you were partnered with somebody who is just super lovely. You know, I used to host the Strictly Tours. I think I did the first 5 years of the Strictly Tours. So I know a lot about the pros and the setup of Strictly, and I loved it. But I know that when you get a partner where the chemistry isn't quite right, that it can be a real struggle. But you and Ali Ash, I mean, and your husband as well, and Jeanette, it's been a loving. You even go on holiday together. There's a proper friendship that's come out of that.
Do you know, he became a huge part of my life overnight. And he knew what he was doing, that lad. And he was very, very considered and careful in the way he did it. And I can just remember the first week, you know, and it must be a really big daunting thing for the whole family. You know, my kids were nervous, didn't know what it meant. I can imagine my husband probably felt a bit nervous, probably a little bit threatened even, not that he'd ever say that, but you put yourself in those shoes. And I remember that first night I brought Ali Ash home after we'd been dancing. I said, do you want to come back and have tea with us? And we pick the kids up from school. And I remember him saying to me, he would pick the kids up from school. He had football cards for them. He was crawling around on the floor playing Lego with them. And then I heard one of them shout, oh, daddy's back. You know, he'd seen Simon drive on the driveway. And Ali Ash just said to me, he says, any chance you can go make yourself scarce half an hour, like take a long shower or something? And I thought, what on earth? So off I went. And obviously he didn't want that awkward moment of the three of us. And he was quite happy to introduce himself. But by the time I came out the shower and had done the whole making myself scarce for half an hour, I found the two of them sitting on the sofa with the football on, with a beer in hand, chatting like he'd been mates for years, while the kids were running around, idolising the ground. He had my whole family eating out the palm of my hand. I remember my dad doing an interview with one of the big Sunday magazines, like partway to the show, and Lou, my PR, was on the call, and she said your dad was crying at one point talking about him being like a third son-in-law. You know, he'd become such a part of the family. My mum and dad idolised him, the in-law, everybody. He made himself a part of our family, and of course brought Jeanette along, because Jeanette, it was the first year she didn't have a partner because she was doing It Takes Two. So we became a bit of a foursome. She'd come up with him on a weekend after we'd, on a Saturday night after we'd danced, and then we'd go for dinner, the four of us, and she'd be round, she'd be in with the kids. And so, like I said, you know, a couple of times last year, they actually came away on holiday with us because they're just an extension of the family now. They're not friends, they are family.
They've been on this podcast, and I'm sure that the listeners fell in love with their story as much as I did. You wish them so well, don't you? You know, they work hard, they dream big, they roll their sleeves up. There's just nothing to not want to support about those two. They're lovely. As well as your fleeting year on Strictly, it's now been 4 years. Is it 4 years or coming up for 5 years now that you've been in the Den?
So I've actually filmed my fifth season of the Den. You guys haven't had a chance to see it yet. But I've filmed, as we're recording this, the fifth one's all filmed and in the can, as they say in TV land. But you won't get to see it for a while yet.
I think it's the only TV show where, as a dragon, you get asked to go on and you spend more than you earn.
a colossal amount. BBC budget's lovely. And it is, I mean, my husband calls it my expensive hobby. So, and I'm like, very expensive hobby. And a lot of people don't realise that it's actually our own money that we're spending, but of course it is. The BBC wouldn't have that sort of money or those sorts of budgets to spend. And they are real life business investments.
Yeah. And you, and also it's not just that initial investment. Once you're in, you're in. The chances are that you're going to need to put more in down the line, give time that you just don't have already because you're already maxed out running your own hugely successful business with a broadcast career, two young children. And your career isn't just UK based. You're everywhere. You're on TV in America, in Germany. You're one of QVC's biggest sellers. And no one sells more craft in the world than you.
Do you know, it's funny because I've just spent the last 2 days actually with my Dragon's Den investment. So I've had all of my investments together for a big 2-day retreat where we can do a big knowledge sharing activity and, you know, we can run sessions and support them, but then also they can support each other. And it was really interesting reflecting on that because a lot of them, they want to understand for me, how do you juggle your time? How do you manage with the mum guilt? And
it's interesting, isn't it? Because do you think a man in your position would be asked about any level of guilt on any of those topics? Do you have parental guilt? Do you feel guilty that, you know, you're pulled in too many directions between all of your successful businesses? It's stuff that we as women feel that we've got to explain, but men never do they?
You know, you're absolute.
I've never heard of dad guilt.
But also, nobody would even ask them about it. Nobody would. It just.
Nobody goes, Peter Jones, how do you do it? I mean, how do you do those school runs? How do you do it, Peter?
And it's interesting that, you know, I'm really lucky in that, you know, my husband is very hands-on in every regard. You know, so we're a husband and wife team running the business. We don't have like paid help at home with the kids. We like to juggle the kids ourselves. We've got brilliant grandparent support. But it means that our life is full on, you know, and it's full on taking a lot of organizing between us. But he accepts that, you know, a lot of my job, I am the front person in our business, and I need to be here, there and everywhere all the time. And so he needs to be the one, you know, I always joke and say I run at 100 mile an hour and leave a massive trail of destruction behind me, and he comes along with a sweeping brush
and he's got a dustbuster behind you. Oh, bloody hell. But you're right, as the front woman of the business, I mean, that's a role that you established in a phone call. And I love the idea that a phone call can change everything in your life. And I think that we all have those phone calls. And for you, it was cold calling Ideal World Shopping Channel and saying, you know that handmade card hour you've got? I've got the enveloper. I can come in and solve a big problem for you. Thank God the person at the other end of the line went, go on then. Because otherwise, would you be here now? I don't know.
Do you know, I can be pretty persuasive when I need to, Kate. and so I'm that person, put me in front of anybody and I can convince anybody of anything. I'm the pitch girl. I fly all over the world pitching myself or pitching my business or pitching one of our products or services, selling our products on TV shopping. And I just knew if I could get a foot in the door and I could get in front of that buyer, I could talk that buyer into letting me go on a TV shopping channel. And then I just knew if I could get on that channel and I could get in front of people and I could show them how absolutely earth-shatteringly brilliant my envelope-making device was, then surely every single person watching would need to buy one that night. And I think it's having that belief.
Conviction.
You know, and the conviction. I know my product was awesome, and don't get me wrong, I'm sure not everybody out there needs an envelope maker in their life, but every crafter did, and you put me in front of them crafters, and I'm so passionate and enthusiastic and excited about what I've got to show them. And quite often it's that passion, enthusiasm and excitement that carries me through every one of those pictures, whatever it is.
But, well, to quote the lovely Marie Kondo, you're sparking joy in people that are already like have a furnace by way of a passion for something, right? They've made these beautiful cards, they put hours and hours into it, loads of thought, and then you go, and here is effectively the box in which to carry your beautiful work, and it will fit any size card because it's not just any old envelope maker. This one can do this. I mean, it goes as big as a small.
Are you after a job? Because you've got the pattern right down.
Well, it's true though, right? It's true. You can make any card of any size. I was like, she has solved so many problems. This even reached like regal ears, didn't it? Because you tell the story, but I know that you were given an MBE in 2016. You were literally about to give birth. So your stomach was almost poking Prince William in his as he tried to put your MBE on you. What did he say?
I had a 50-pound bump as I waddled up to Prince William. And you know, so you're not allowed to turn your back on royalty. So when I went up to get my MBE, I had to waddle up to him, curtsy, and then I had to waddle backwards again. Buy a beautiful dress because I had to buy whatever maternity dress they had. I splurged on the shoes. So the shoes were where the whole budget for the MBE outfit had gone. These wonderful 4-inch Lubies. So honestly, to this day, they're my favourite pair of shoes. But anyway, I'm sure someone whispers in Prince William's ear, you know, I was going to say Prince William. We asked him Prince William. It's because I keep calling Prince Charles, and we know he's King Charles now.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? It's a change of guard, quite literally. But also, they get briefing notes, and they are incredibly fastidious and professional. Yes. They read their notes.
Do you know, and so as I waddled up to him, he says to me, wow. Well, first of all, he said, wow, that looks like it's coming soon. And I was like, yeah, it really is, this week. And I actually went on to give birth 2 days later. I got the train from London I got off at Durham train station, went straight to the hospital, and they admitted me that afternoon. I gave birth the next day. But after saying my bump was tremendously big, he said to me, that enveloper you invented, that's a great product, isn't it? And I was so taken aback, because in my head I was thinking, oh my god, has Prince William been watching me on the shopping channels? And obviously someone's just prepared a really good briefing pack, but in that moment I look back now, and one of my biggest regrets in life is that I'm not quick-witted enough to have said something to him like, oh, does your grandma make cards? Like, I wish if I had that moment again. That's what I said. Does your grandma make cards?
But he sends enough, doesn't he? So, you know, and maybe there's an enveloper on many a desk in Buckingham Palace.
You never know.
You just don't know.
You never know.
But who would have thought, that one device that you cooked up with your dad and the help of a local carpenter took you all the way to Buckingham Palace with millions of pounds worth of sales under your belt alongside your husband. I mean, literally, Sheridan Smith leads to play you and tell this story. It's great.
One day,
I love it.
Rodney, one day.
One day. We'll be, yeah, and you already are. It's not even we're going to be millionaires. You already are. Are you ready to dive in on your first question?
Ooh, go on, hit me.
You talk about being underestimated, and that really resonated with me because I was quite young starting out and found that people would quite often, as was I'm sure your experience, underestimate you, which I think gave us huge advantage. Rather than moan about it, I just kind of seized the opportunity. So I wondered, has that been your experience? How have you been underestimated, and how have you turned it to your advantage?
I have to say that is the one downside that has come with, like, in inverted commas, a celebrity status. Is the best thing about me was I used to love that I was underestimated all the time. The problem is they put you on a big national show like Dragon's Den. Nobody underestimates me anymore.
No, well, now they know you're the real deal.
Lost the power of surprise. But my whole life, and it was, you know, I was always the girl that sounded like this. And do you know, I'm Northern and proud, so I have never even tried to lose this accent, put a posh telephone voice on. You know, I just, you know, I can go anywhere in the world and people know where I'm from. And the good, the bad, and the ugly, the people have that perception with it. And so people always look down their nose at me a little bit because clearly I wasn't as smart as they were or as well-to-do as they were because I was from the Northeast. But then also I was always the woman in the room that was all full of men because, you know, essentially, I had a manufacturing business. Even just being in business, you know, you come across some women, but not that many, and it's certainly not at my age. I was always the young person in the room, so I was always. Mm-hmm. It was either because I was young, I was a woman, or I was Northern, and I remember even before me kind of business days, even at university, I remember I went to York. And pretty much most of the kids who go to York are the ones that weren't quite good enough to get into Oxford and Cambridge. And they have a chip on their shoulder. And I remember it was quite an elitist course. They'd only took 30 in there. And most of the others had been through private educations. And they did, that, you know, you could just tell they'd grown up with a little bit of a silver spoon in their mouth. And people just looked down their nose at me. I'd come from a state school. I didn't walk the walk. I didn't talk the talk. And they assumed I just wouldn't be as good as they were. And I remember it's that delight when you surprise people. You know, when we got our first set of exam results and everyone was expecting me to be the bottom of the pile and I wasn't. Or when I'm the one that's in the room and I'm the one that's putting my hand up because I know the answers to the questions. And little by little over the few years, I watched those people underestimate me and underestimate me at their peril. And I remember it was, I think people always ask me what my proudest achievement in life was. And it was, I always say, I started my business in my last year of uni. So I did the 2 years studying, a year working in industry, started the business whilst I was in my university bedroom in my last year. And the university course, they were really discouraging of me starting the business. They wanted me to finish my course, to get my degree, to get the bit of paper, and then start the business.
But that's such an oxymoron, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. And the thing,
because ultimately you're setting yourself up to start a business and it started so... Like, yeah. What?
And if I'm one of these people, if I have an idea, we're doing it yesterday. You know, there's no way I was going to sit on my hands and wait till I graduated. And their rationale for thinking I couldn't do it, they'd underestimated me. They didn't assume that I could do the business, build the business, and still complete my university course. And also, by the end of my second year, I'd become the highest grading student on the course. And so my tutors, going from the one that was barely getting on the course a few years, the one they underestimated. So the tutors thought, well, she's not going to complete and she's going to miss out on that first class honours degree. And I remember working my little socks off in my last year. And if I ever think now that I'm busy, I look back on that last year. And I remember building the business and having to deal with the demands of the business during the day and having to do all of my studies and everything on an evening from my university bedroom. And I graduated at the end of that summer. And not only did I have the business that I'd built up over the 9 months, it was turning over $500,000, which was bigger than my mum and dad's business. They'd been growing for 20 odd years. It was the fact that I still graduated and got that first class honours and was still not only top of the class, but I was the highest achieving student in the management school. And I felt like going around and waving that bit of paper in the faces of all those tutors who said I shouldn't do it and I couldn't do it and thinking, I'll show you who can't do it, pet.
Exactly. Pet. I bet you didn't call him pet.
You might have done known name.
Might have been a bit spicier than that, I hope. Do you know what, though? It's interesting, isn't it? Because we're all measured by society standards, be it in our national curriculum. That's a measurement of, you know, are you an A student, a B student, a C student, whatever. And you kind of get put in a lane. And I think you're a really brilliant example of, you know, like you said, you didn't have the top grades, but you had the top drive. And you can't measure that. You can't measure how far that determination, that grit, that work ethic can take you. And I know you're a big believer in a mediocre idea can fly under the guidance of a brilliant entrepreneur, but a brilliant idea will struggle to find traction with a mediocre entrepreneur. So I think, you know, you are the embodiment of that. And isn't it fun when people underestimate you and you know that you've got something in your back pocket to poke them in the eye with?
Always. I've got more chance to be underestimated now. But the thing is, you know, I can tell you now, most rooms that I'm in, I'm not the smartest person in the room, you know, and I know that, and I'm good with that. But I can tell you what, there'll never be anybody in that room who's got anywhere near as much drive and determination as what I've got. And I know how to turn that drive and determination around to make me the winner in any situation. And I think it's that self-belief and that pushing yourself forward. You know, it's not about, you know, I'm the cleverest person. You know, I didn't come top of that course at university because I was the smartest person on the course. I was just the one who worked the hardest. And it's the same. It's the same with anything in life. If you have enough drive, you'll succeed at what you're doing.
So how does that work in a room full of dragons? Because then you are actually arguably in a room full of people that have got that same level of furious determination that you have.
So I can remember it was... I mean, my first couple of years, I suffered so badly from imposter syndrome. I mean, don't we all? And I would sit there in that chair thinking, oh my God, how did I get to be here? I'm not good enough to be here. You know, those other dragons are smarter than I am. They've got bigger businesses than I have. They've got more experience than I have. They've got a bigger net worth than I've got. Well, you know, whatever it was. And then just assuming every entrepreneur walking through the door, well, if I make an offer and one of those other dragons makes an offer, why would they ever pick me? They're always going to pick the others because the others are better than me. And it was just that lacking in self-belief, which is really out of character for me now. But it was, you know, that it was that. But you try sitting in a room with them incredible business people and see how you feel. And I think what it is I've carved out my own place in that den, and it's I'm known now for what I bring to the table. And it's so heartwarming when you see an entrepreneur walk through the lift doors now. And now I've been on the show a few years and people know a little bit more about me and who I am and what I can do, what I can bring to the table, what I've done for my other investments. And they'll come in and I'm not frightened anymore to take one of the other dragons on. I used to be a little bit apprehensive if I thought, oh, this is a great investment. I think I'll be great for them. But I'm frightened to go up against one of the others because nobody wants to have their ego bruised. And it's like being the kid in the school playground who gets picked last. That's exactly what it's like.
But nobody thinks of the dragons feeling like that.
We do. We do. And I remember I would never want to put myself, I would always pull out of, if there was going to be a good dip, I thought, oh, they're totally going to go for such and such another dragon. And I don't blame them. So I'm just going to make an excuse to pull out of this one. Now I won't. Now I'll go in and I'll fight for it because I know I'm the best dragon for them. You know, so like, when I'm not, I won't. But if I know and I feel it in my gut that I'm the right dragon for them, I'm not frightened to tell that entrepreneur that I am. And because I've learned not to take it personally. If they don't pick me and they go with something else, I think, well, you know what? Doesn't mean that I'm not great. It's just that in this moment, they wanted that other dragon for what they had instead, or the other dragon pitched a little bit better than I did, or whatever it was. But I'm no longer frightened. I'm not suffering from that imposter syndrome anymore. I'm pleased. I'm proud of myself for being there, and I'm happy to take on that role.
Isn't it interesting that you've thrived on being underestimated and having never underestimated yourself until you found yourself in a room full of like-minded people, and then you started to underestimate yourself?
You do. And then what? Nobody's underestimating me, and I kind of want to be underestimated a little bit.
Shit. I need some of that back. Please stop expecting so much of me. Well, I hope you continue to surpass all expectations. Before we move on to the next question, did you ever feel underestimated by the world of business, especially the world of shopping television? Because I've dipped my toes in, and so I have huge respect for what you do. And a good friend of mine who's been on the show, Ruth Langsford, came on and talked about her ventures at QVC. I mean, Ruth's one of the biggest sellers that they have, huge. And Brenda Edwards has just been on. She's got a line that she's launching with QVC. It's a really smart business model. Did you, as an unknown, feel that you were underestimated walking in there? And when did you feel like you'd turn that around and people started taking you seriously?
See, what was interesting for me is I really made a name for myself on shopping TV more in America than I did here. So, which was good because it meant I could do my thing over here. But then over in America, nobody knew me. And I was different because I talked differently. I had this cute accent, they used to call it. And I remember I used to study the other presenters. I used to watch them. I used to watch their every move. I used to psychoanalyze.
It's an art form.
Why did I feel all the way they did? It's so clever. Yeah. And they put me through so much training. So I spent years and years and years perfecting my craft. But in the US, shopping telly is massive. You know, it's still a little bit niche here. Over in there, they have like nearly 100 channels just of different shopping channels and infomercial channels. And so it's a thing. So I guess over there, you're not... people aren't frightened to be right up in your face and really rah-rah and down the lens and confident. And when you're in that environment and you're surrounded by all these confident people, it rubs off. And whereas over here in the UK, we were a little bit more reserved, we were a little bit more humble and everything. So then when I brought back all this stuff I'd learned from doing so much TV in the US and put it on TV here, and then actually I tell you what was invaluable for me, doing TV in Germany. Because in Germany, obviously I don't speak any German. Ja, das ist sehr gut. coat is about as far as I can get. A Kaisersara.
So how do you do it?
So they have somebody sitting in a little box in the corner, which is, it's like in a little cupboard, all sealed off, and they live lip sync you. They literally live lip sync, right? Now, here's something I learned, okay? So the way that channel works is they only want German speaking on there, but they wanted me because I am my brand and, you know, I know my products better than anyone else. So lovely Linda has been working with me for like over 10 years now. She sits in the cupboard. And as I'm speaking, my voice, my mouth opens and Linda's voice comes out. And the problem is, what I've learned is, did you know that only 7% of the what someone hears when you speak to them are the actual physical words that you say, right? The other 93% is, so 50-something percent is all your body language, and then this 30-odd percent is your intonation, and then the actual physical words are very, very, it's 7%, right? So what I learned to do and what I taught myself to do a bit more is over-accentuate all of my body language. So that if I know people buy my products because I get super excited, and you need to know I'm super excited, so I need to articulate it with my body language. And if I need Linda poor Linda is having to listen to what I'm saying and physically translate it in that moment, in the English goes into her ear, out the German comes out of her mouth. So if I want Linda to get excited, I have to really G up the excitement. And so I learned to over-exaggerate everything. So that.
But that's performance, isn't it?
It's performance. And because I'd learned that, I think bringing that then into my presentation in the UK shopping channels, you know, I am just, I've learned to dial up whatever I feel inside. I've learned to dial it up through every other one of my senses. So it's not just what I'm saying. And then you compound that with the confidence I've got from doing the US. I kind of became this stealth, like growing my presentation skills. And like you said, you know, something else I'm incredibly proud of, there's nobody in the world can sell craft stuff on telly like I can.
You are, I believe, the most successful in your field.
Thank you. I've worked a lot of years to get there. That's not an accolade that happens overnight. Like, I have studied the people who are the most successful in their field in every area of TV shopping and learned how to model myself on them.
And you know, those shows. So when you get, so a TSV, right, is like the holy grail in QVC land, isn't it? So the TSV is today's special value. Now, if you get a TSV, you're kind of there for hours. You're on, you're off, and you keep going back selling your TSV. But the numbers translate into huge profit, don't they? What's the sort of, like, if you get a TSV in America, what kind of numbers can you expect to do?
I think my highest ever gross an hour, I did well over $500,000 in sales in the hour.
Wow. Selling craft things. Sorry, I'm sure there's a better terminology than things.
Stuff, we sometimes say.
Stuff, there we go.
There you go. Yeah, selling our craftwares. Yes, it is.
£500,000 in an hour.
In an hour, yeah. And I think my biggest ever day, I did 3.2 million of sales on the day. You know, just being on and off every couple of hours, I'd do another 20 minutes in that hour, then I'd do a full hour here and... It's astronomical. People have no idea the power of shopping TV. And as a result, all of the products that I develop them to be sold through the medium of TV. Most of my products, you walk into a craft store and you see it hanging on a shelf. See that enveloper hanging on a shelf? You'd have wouldn't have a Scooby-Doo. I'll just buy that pack of white envelopes for $2.99 instead. Whereas when you're on shopping TV, you sell the problem. And then once you've solved the problem, your product's the solution to the problem. But you can explain that to people. And, you know, people who, so many people over here just don't understand how amazing shopping TV. I mean, I'm like a shopping TV buying addict. Because you watch the show, you know, it's terrible when I'm down at QVC. I spend a blooming fortune.
And it's volume, right? They can buy huge units, which allows them to give really competitive prices to their customers. But when you're in the green room there, so you can see if you're about to go on and do your hour, you can see who else is on at the moment. You know, you can see their sales live on the screens. It's like being in the city. You're like, oh my God, they're really shifting units. Look at that TSV. It's going through the roof. And then, you know, you get in the car to come home and you've got some sort of ninja fryer, a bloody leaf blower. And you realise that you're no better than anybody else. You've got sucked in on all those deals too.
That's it. That is it.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Are you ready for your next question?
Hit me.
You and Simon have been together since you were 15, and we've seen you share your story of how you grew your business together. But can you tell me how you've managed to grow your marriage and remain on the same page all the while working together? Because to grow together, to stay on the same page in a world that is ever moving, ever changing, I just don't know how you've done it. How have you done it? What's your recipe for marital success?
You know, the irony is, I always say, me and Simon are like chalk and cheese. We are the complete opposites in every regard. And I always joke and say, it's not that we're not on the same page. It's that we're in different libraries. Not just different books. We're so different like that. But I can tell you exactly what it is that's worked for us. Is I think our whole relationship, everything we do, is just built on respect, ultimate respect and ultimate trust. And I just remember, so like I said, we were 15 when we got together, and oh, I can just see him walking up the stairs in the office, bless him, doesn't know I'm talking about him. 15 when we got together, and it wasn't even like love at first sight. He was the star of the local cricket team. I was the scorer. He used to go with me dad on a Saturday afternoon. He came in the score box, asked for my phone number, said he could give us a lift to the next game. And then when he rang us, asked us out on a date, I was like, sorry, why would I want to go there with you? Because there's not a game on. I thought you were just giving us a lift to the game. And he chased us for a few weeks, convinced us to have a look out with him. And then the rest is history, 24 years later. And 24 years. It was our 16th wedding anniversary just a couple of weeks ago. And it's one of those things. It's, we're so different, but we have this total respect of what the other one does and brings to the table. And for me, so because I was 15, he was 19, he's always had them, you know, he's been a few years older than me at a different stage in his life in some respects. So when I was at university and started the business, he'd already graduated and he was starting to earn. So he was saving money so that we could buy our first house. So by the time I graduated and finished university, he'd saved up enough to pay a deposit on our house because he stayed living at his mum and dad's house, even though he didn't want to, so they could save all of his wages. And I started the business, and we could afford for me not to have to draw a wage from the business because he could afford to pay our mortgage and essentially keep me so that I could put everything back into the business. And then he supported me emotionally as well as financially through that stage. And I remember it was a few years later, we were coming to get married and we never saw each other. We were like ships that passed in the night. He had this huge corporate job, worked for a big European company, used to travel quite often midweek. I was building my brand, doing a lot of consumer shows on a weekend. So quite often I would go away on a Thursday or Friday when he would be getting home and I was away. And then I'd land back, you know, 12, 1 o'clock on through the night, Sunday night, and he'd be leaving again on a flight getting up at 4 o'clock on the Monday morning. So we were just ships that passed in the night. And I remember it was just one day he came home from work and he said, I've worked out, we were going through a really challenging patch in the business. I was going through a big legal battle defending one of my patents. And it was quite clear I'd kind of hit breaking point in the business in terms of I don't have all the skills that you need to run a business. And I'm not shy to say that. I know what I'm great at, but then I know what I'm not great at. Now I'm the front woman. I'm the ideas woman. And so I'm out there doing the jazz hands, doing the pitching, developing the products, doing the sales. There was no Simon behind me sweeping up all the pieces in the business because he had his own job, and he just came home one day and he said, "I've handed my notice in. I've worked out there's enough money because he was an accountant, so he used to run all the accounts for the business. He says I've worked out there's enough money we can draw down. We owed £140,000 on our mortgage. He says we can draw down the £140,000, pay our mortgage off. We can live if we take a wage of £10,000 each. We can afford to live on £20,000 if we don't have a mortgage to pay. So then he said, I'll come and run the business, and you go and do your thing in the business. And the thing is, he loved his job. He loved the company. He'd been on a fast track through management. He was really going places. He used to get up every morning, freshly shaven, shirt and tie for work. Whereas I look now, he hasn't had a shave in 15 years. and he went from that and that life to come in. And, you know, he was managing multi-million euro business, business divisions, to running a business that had 8 staff and a couple of million turnover. And I can,
taking 10 grand a year.
Taking 10 grand a year salary. And I can see that wasn't fulfilling for him. Like, that wasn't a fulfilling career and a fulfilling job. But he was prepared to do that because it was the right thing for us as a family. You know, and he said, we'll do this. We'll give it our all for the next few years. If it doesn't work, I can always go back and get another job like that. But this is the only way we can have a life and we can see each other together. We'll put everything into the business. And then in a few years' time, you'll be able to take a bit of a step back and have the family. And, he kind of sacrificed what he wanted to do and his life plan so that we could have the best life plan as a family, as it was. And he still does that to this day. You know, everything he does, he does what's right for our family. And I think for me, I would never, ever in a million years have ever asked him to do that. Why should he give up his career so I could have mine? But I didn't have to ask him, he just did it. And I felt this weight on my shoulders for all these years of my motivation then became, I wanted to grow the business so that it was big enough to justify his skill set and so that it would be big enough for him to enjoy running it. I wanted to make the business the size it was for him to have that career satisfaction and fulfillment again because he'd given up his career for me. And that drove me for years. And we never, ever discussed this. It's not that we're not big talkers, I am. I don't talk for England. Simon, probably just because he's never got a word in edgeway for 24 years.
He's stopped trying.
He's not a talker. And so we never talk about feelings or anything like that. But I always held on to that. And it's the same in our everyday life. I have so much respect for everything he did for me to be able to have this life. And he has an enormous amount of respect for a lot of the sacrifices I make now for the business to be successful, which affords us the life that we have as well. And we're a brilliant team.
Have you ever said to him what you've just shared with me?
I couldn't find the words to say that to him. Like that would feel awkward. But I can tell you, I did so 8 years ago now. It was our 10th business anniversary at work, and we had this huge big do, and we flew in all of our top customers and suppliers and staff from around the world. We had 300.
Yeah, you have staff in different countries, don't you? You employ about 200 and something.
Yep. Literally all over the world, offices in California. So I flew all these, and this was 8 years ago, so it was our 10th birthday, flew them all in. And I stood up on stage and I wanted to do a speech for the kind of 10-year history of the business. He'll laugh, this is totally me. So I'd put myself 45 minutes in the schedule, and we were about 50, 55 minutes in, and they're trying to tell me to wrap up, and I was on year two. I shouted off to the compere, "You can wind your neck in, mate, because it's my gig, it's my business, and I'm going to keep talking." In fairness, I got to about an hour and 15 minutes. I galloped through the last eight years of the business. But at that point, I'd explained to people like a little bit of this about the dynamic and the – how it feels when I know that I'm the one that everyone looks up to in the business, or on, in this respect, people see me on TV, they see me in Dragon's Den, and they only see me. I'm the front one. What they don't see is I'm one half of a team, and this version of me wouldn't exist and wouldn't be this good if it wasn't behind it. You know, behind every, I'm a firm believer in that whole thing, behind every great woman, there's a great man making it possible. And he's not, there's no ego. He's not bothered about being the front guy. He doesn't mind being the guy in the background that nobody knows. And I spoke about that to that room of people and got quite emotional. And I think it's the first time, so I couldn't say it to him, but I could say it to other people with him in the room. And that's the first time I managed to ever say that. Yeah.
That's lovely. I think yours is the most extraordinary sort of romance. The way that you're, I mean, I think a therapist would call it your love language, but you do it through sort of, you do it through business moves. It's like, you know, okay, I'm going to quit my job and come and support you. Okay, well, then I'm going to make the biggest business so big it's going to be worth that justification. And actually, when you rewind it all the way back, the reason you ended up in craft and you came up with the enveloper was because in your year away, you didn't want to be away from him. You didn't want to go to London and find a job and be away from him. So you found a local business that just happened to do craft, which enabled you to still be in your relationship with him. So it's something you two have always done.
Yeah, we always like to be together. We don't live in each other's pockets. I don't know what's going on in his life all the time and vice versa. You know, we're quite independent in some ways. But yes, I like to... We're together all the time. You know, that's what we do. And I couldn't think of anything worse of having to... I chose York University because it was far enough away from home to justify the tens of thousands of pounds my parents were going to have to spend on putting us at uni, but close enough to home that I could still see Simon every weekend. So, yeah.
You've always been one half of each other.
Yep. And it's all I've ever known now. You know, I can't remember because it's since I was 15, so I've never known life without Simon, really.
How do you align yourself as parents? Because that's always a different dynamic, isn't it? Suddenly you think that, oh well, we're on the same page in business, we're on the same page in our relationship. Is it the case with the boys?
Do you know, I think, and I understand now why our relationship works. So I've got an amazing leadership coach. She's worked with me for 5 or 6 years now, does a lot of coaching one-to-one with me and with the senior staff in our business. And she's helped me understand the things that just my gut tell me. And she boils everything always back down to values. And what I realize now is, you know, I've out of all the boys I could have picked, or out of the, you know, he was my first boyfriend, so technically the first boy that chased me that I decided, yeah, he's quite nice, I'll go out with him. Actually, it's because we have the same values. We've been brought up very, very, our parents are very different as people, but they've got the same underlying values, and we've been brought up with those same family values. And now as we bring our kids up, we never disagree on the values that we're bringing our kids up with. And I think everything else is just noise. The values is all that really, really matters. And so it's, you know, it's really hard. I can tell you. So I think the reason we are grounded, if I speak just for myself, the reason I'm as grounded as I am is the upbringing I had. You know, we didn't have two bob and a conker when I was little. You know, I was the kid that went to school in the Adidas four-stripe tracksuit bottoms, and, you know, they'd have to get me my new school bag every year came from the car boot sale, you know, and I didn't mind that. You know, it was who I was, and we certainly couldn't afford to have big family holidays. You know, my dad had a transport company, so every winter he used to get one of the vans that was decommissioned, and he would go at the tip, get an old caravan from the tip, and then he would spend the winter fitting the bits from the caravan into the old van, and we'd use it as a camper van and go camping in the summer. That was our summer holidays. And I think it's stuff like that has made me the person, that's made me appreciate money the way I do and appreciate real family values. And I want my kids to grow up that way. Now, you know, I could afford to put my kids first class on an aeroplane to the most expensive, luxurious 5-star resorts in the world, but what's that going to teach them about life? And so, you know, and we don't ever argue on this stuff. You know, neither of us want to do that with our kids. Mind, I tell you what, Simon will not camp. So
I was going to say, he's all behind you until he has to like get in a camper van, and then he's like, you take the boys, and I don't know, what does he do? Go to the Maldives?
Thankfully, he's not a big holiday person. So I spent the first 2 weeks of the summer holidays touring around Scotland in my homemade camper van that my dad built for us, whilst Simon just stayed and worked. And it was, so it was me and the two boys in my big camper, and my mum and dad in their camper. Thankfully, I had some help with my mum and dad. But he will not entertain the idea of the camper van. But little things like, you know, when we do go away on a holiday, I always say you can hear people whispering in the airport. Our local airport, they only do a couple of flights a day. It's tiny. And I can remember, I can hear someone going, oh my God, I'm sure that's that lass off Dragon's Den. And someone else is going, don't be stupid, it can't be. They've only got a Ryanair flight out of here in the next 2 hours. She's not going to be on that, is she not? And I am, you know, I am on that Ryanair flight, because that's just the normal stuff.
How has money changed you in success as a couple? Because, I mean, you've made serious money. You've made life-changing sums of money. And you've just explained how you try to not let that impact the values that you hold dear. So it's obviously a conversation you've had.
It is, and it's finding that balance around, you know, so we're lucky that we can afford to send our kids to private school, and they go to a wonderful school near us, and the money that we earn affords us that luxury to do that. But it doesn't mean that I want my kids, because I had a regular state education, and Simon had a private education, and he saw the value that he got from, you know, the smaller class sizes and the more one-to-one time they get. And he actually started a savings fund to pay for our kids to go to private school when we'd been dating for 3 months. So I was 15, and my boyfriend he'd set up like an ISA with the bank to start saving for our kids to go.
He is a strategist and a great saver.
It's good, isn't it? But he'd been to private school, but not because his parents could have afforded to pay for it, but he'd got a scholarship. And I think he really felt grateful for that opportunity he'd been given in life. And he wanted to work hard to give his kids the same opportunity. And I think that's what we want, to give them the opportunities. We just don't want them to have a lavish lifestyle that'll mean that they don't appreciate or value the things that we believe are important.
No sense of entitlement.
No, that's the way to put it. No sense of entitlement. Yeah.
Well, sounds like you're managing your millions very well, and you've worked very hard for them. So good on you. I think we get so British sometimes about money. And I think people are more likely to talk about their sex lives than their financial lives, which is extraordinary, isn't it? But you know what? You're self-made. You shouldn't have to reduce your achievements so that it feels more comfortable for other people. Congratulations to you both on your extraordinary success, and may many more millions fall into your lap.
Thank you. You know, that's the first time someone said it to me like that. And you're right. You don't like to talk about it. You don't. But the problem is, you know, I do it sometimes, and I know I shouldn't, but I go and Google myself so that I can see what people are Googling about me.
And oh, don't do that. That's self-harm.
But it's every time, it's always Sarah Davies' net worth. That's all anybody ever wants to know, is how many millions is that girl worth? Or when I did Strictly, I would be Sarah Davies' Argentinian tango. I was like, yes, come on.
But it was worth a bloody fortune.
Yes, but, I don't want that, you know, to be the thing that defines me.
No, but in so many ways, why not? Because in America, they would be shouting this from the rooftops. They celebrate success and they wear it really proudly. And we don't. We sort of, you'd be more likely to talk about being a millionaire if you won the lottery, because that seems okay. You're just lucky.
Yeah.
But actually, you're just bloody hard working, and you came up with a solution that loads of crafters thought was, you know, brilliant. Even the future King of England commended you on it.
You know, you say that about the lottery. I can always remember one of the things I really hate people saying to me is when people say, oh, you're lucky. And I think it's not luck. It's really hard work. And I can remember once, it was a few years after, I think I was in uni, after I'd graduated from uni, that's right, yeah. And I went to, I met up with a couple of the girls I'd been at school with like 10 years earlier. And I'd bought myself my first little fancy car, and it was a Merc hard top convertible. And I pulled up to this party in my Merc hard top convertible. And one of my friends came out, and she like leaned herself on the bonnet in a half drunken state. And she went, oh, you're so lucky, you. You and Joanne, you've been so lucky. And I could have hit the woman. And So to give you the context, the other girl, Joanna, who she's talking about, her dad had won the Irish lottery. And so she just put me in that camp of, you know, you and Joanne, you've got all this money now because you've got your money and Joanne's dad's won the lot. And I just remember being incensed at that time. And since then, I've hated people saying, you're lucky. And don't get me wrong, every business that's got to this stage has had its sprinkling of luck somewhere along the line, you know, sprinkling of magic. But it's not luck that gives you that puts the millions in the bank. It's bloody hard work.
Absolutely. Which takes me nicely to my final question.
Hit me.
In Dragon's Den, you offer up not only your money, but also your time and your acquired wisdom, mentoring businesses and business owners. But who have been the mentors and the greatest teachers that have crossed your path, and what did they bring to your table?
So I get asked about mentoring all the time, and I think it is so critically important. And I'm a big believer in that you are a product of the people you surround yourself with. And I've chosen actively to surround myself with certain people, or I make more time in my life from certain people. And it's either people that I look up to and I'm learning from, or actually as I've developed in life, and it's less that I come across those people less in my life. It's people who fill my tank up a little bit. That's how I describe it. Yeah. You know, it's like every time I spend time with Aliash, it just fills my tank up. You know, he's got all that to give and all that love, and it just makes...
It's like a B12 of friendship, isn't it? It's like, oh, I feel good now. Yeah. Like a shot in the ass. Yeah.
it's just, I always think you'd be very selective. You'll all know, you'll have those friends who are the ones that are, they just feel like they've been dealt a hard hand in life, and they're just a bit of an energy suck. And every time you see them, they're a little bit negative. And trust me, spending time with them, they're a leech. They'll leech your energy out.
Mood hoovers, yeah.
And I just choose not to spend my time with them. But the counter of that is mentors and people who've been impactful. And I always say mentors fall into two categories. It's the ones who know they're mentoring you and the ones that don't. So for example, you know, you don't become the best in your field at shopping TV without having been mentored a lot. You know, Ruth Langsford has mentored me in the world of shopping telly and never known a thing about it. She didn't know that I spent hours and hours and hours watching her shows, you know, analysing how she made me feel, why she made me feel that way. How am I going to be more like Ruth? How can I learn? And so, but I would, this is long before I met Ruth, I knew Ruth as a person, but I was watching her and I was learning.
Because she actually started on shopping, well, she didn't start on shopping telly, but she did shopping telly before going on to do things like This Morning, right? Is that, have I got that right? Travel shows and things, is that right? Travel deals, I think.
You might know more than me. I just know as I've been going, I've been watching a lot of Ruth Langsford and building that up. And, you know, it's the same with so many people. All, you know, you can, like Duncan Bannatyne. Because I read his autobiography, it really resonated with me. And I watched his show, you know, from being on Dragon's Den very early, I watched everything he did. And I would model myself on a lot of the behaviours he would do in business, and not the ones I didn't like, the ones I did like, I would take. Mm-hmm. And so many mentors I use like that. But then also there's people who do know that they're mentoring you. So I can tell you, for example, just looking at a few of the other dragons, you know, we had Theo Pafitis. He was never in the den at the same time as me, but he came and did a guest spot on my first year and then on my second year filling in for some of the other dragons. He is an incredible man, and he really took me under his wing. And, you know, I remember a couple of times we went out to dinner, and he would be so giving of his time. And I would talk to him about challenges I'm having in my business, and he would give me his advice and opinion. And he was a brilliant hands-on mentor. And Tuca Solomon, one of the other dragons, you know, on my first day in the den, I walked into the den and he had done my screen test. And I said to him, I don't know if you remember me, you did my screen test. He said, oh, I remember you, love. He said, I told the BBC she's the one you need to hire, and I'm glad they listened to us. And I said, well, brilliant. I said, but I've got no idea what I'm doing now, so I've decided you're going to mentor me, if that's okay. And I certainly find, as a younger woman, you say that to an older man in your face, and I saw his little chest puff out. And he was so thrilled that I was there and I wanted to learn from him. But I always say with mentoring, set out about the rules of engagement, you know, because people don't know what does mentoring mean. I was like, well, have I got time to do it? And I said to him, all I was hoping was, you know, after every pitch we do in the den and we're having a cup of tea in the green room, will you just give me a bit of feedback on how I did and maybe where I could have done better or what you thought about that? And essentially, I'm giving him permission to criticise me. Because most people don't want to give you feedback because you just don't walk up to somebody, especially a colleague like that, and say, do you know what? You could have done this a bit better. But how am I ever going to get better if someone doesn't tell me?
But actually, you're asking him to coach you and produce you. It can take the form of criticism, but how else do you get better?
How else do you get better? So I wouldn't dream of just going up to, you know, Stephen Bartlett was the next dragon that started after me. I wouldn't just go up to Stephen in the green room and go, do you know that pitch? If you just phrased it like this and come across like this, I think they would have been a bit more engaged. I wouldn't dream of it. But if he'd said to me, well, could you give me some feedback on how you think, I'd be delighted to give him all of my feedback. And I think it's just about being, you can only improve through feedback. And so I try and create environments with people where they feel they can give me feedback. And I'm that sort of person who wants to be open to feedback. And feedback can come peer-to-peer level. It can come from people above you. You know, my chairman in the business mentors me a lot and does a lot of feedback with me. People below me, I encourage a lot of my staff to feedback to me as a leader. You know, how could I be a better leader in that environment? Mm-hmm. And that's how you become better at whatever you do. So I think it's so critical to surround yourself with the right people, but also create an environment where you are able to get feedback and keep continually improving. Every day is a school day, Kate.
Every day is a school day, especially in a world that changes so quickly now. We have to be so nimble to be able to adapt. I mean, when you launched the Enveloper, the internet wasn't a place where you sold stuff.
No, wasn't.
But and now look, you know. Yeah. It was all about, oh, God, could we shop? It was shopping TV and can you get on the high street? But, you know, high street's full of restaurants now.
And now I need to be getting down with the kids and making envelopes on TikTok instead or something. You know, it's you.
Exactly.
Capture the world.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I say to my son quite a lot, and I'm sure this will resonate with you, with your children at the age they are now, you'll probably end up doing a job that hasn't even yet been invented. So how do we prepare you for a future that is so unknown? All you've got to do is just learn the basics, but, you know, stay alive to opportunities that have yet to even sort of realise that they are one.
Yes.
Because that's the world we live in. But what's interesting is, you know, you are a business leader. You sit at the top of the tree alongside Simon with your business, and yet you have actively sought a business coach because you've recognised that actually I need somebody to grow me. I can't just grow this business. I've got to grow with it. Otherwise, you get left behind or the business gets left behind. Something's going to grind and not work.
I think, and I see it a lot in entrepreneurs now, I think the biggest thing holding back any entrepreneur is themselves in thinking that they are the finished article. They are as good as they can be, you know, and it's you've got to be on that path of continuous self-development and improvement. You can always be better and there is always somebody out there that's better than you. And the only way to keep staying ahead is to keep learning. You know, I've not been shy in saying, you know, I'm brilliant at what I do on TV shopping. Doesn't mean I don't work really hard every day at how I get a little bit better. I still seek feedback from all of my producers, other presenters I work with. I still psychoanalyze other people I watch on TV. Why are they good? What can I learn from them? How can I tweak and adapt my style a little bit further?
Because you're still driven. You're still curious, you're still interested, you're hungry.
You've got to be. And the day you stop being, craggy, I don't even imagine what that would look like.
Retirement.
Who do? I couldn't imagine retiring.
I'm sorry, I feel like I've just insulted you. Sarah, thank you. Good luck with the book. It's full of everything that you've learnt across the years by way of crafting, beautifully demonstrated. My mother is going to be all over it like a hot rash. You wait. This place at Christmas is going to look like your place at Christmas.
I'll wait to see some pictures.
Yeah, don't worry. They'll be all over the grid. My huge thanks to Sarah. What a fascinating lady she is. Her new book, Craft Your Year with Saira Davis, is out now and is available wherever you get your books. For more chats with some of the brilliant men and women that Saira's worked alongside, we've got episodes in our back catalogue with Jeanette and Ali Ash from Strictly. Head judge Shirley Ballas is in there, Craig Revel Hallward from the Strictly panel, Fred Syriax and Ruth Langsford. They are all residing in our back catalogue, ready for you to wrap your ears around them. I'll be back on Tuesday, back on your feeds with another midweek serving of vintage chat with another episode of Something from the Cellar. Until then, thanks so much for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.